What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Today, I have another Q&A podcast episode teed up for us. So I'm excited to dive into a handful of these questions. I've taken these over the last couple of weeks. We've gone through Halloween, the first part of November. We're kind of already mid-November heading into Thanksgiving here in a couple of weeks, but a lot of good questions, a lot of things that I think are pertinent to this time of the year and just things that I don't think I've talked a ton about on the podcast. And I think I have like 10 questions here, but I have a hard cutoff here in the next like 30, 35 minutes or so because I start my coaching call stack for the day. So I'm going to try and get through as many as possible and I'm going to shut up now. Let's just get to it. First question we have is eating candy during workouts actually good for you? And this question, I had a Halloween kind of Q&A over the last couple of weeks and I got this question because I think this time of the year, like the emergence of candies, the emergence of shit that you don't eat other than around the holidays or other, you know, other times around like Halloween for the year, like a lot of people aren't out here eating Starbursts every other, you know, every other month, right? A lot of people aren't here buying Skittles or aren't out here buying, you know, hard candies or chocolates or some of these things. So there's a ton of exposure to different candies, treats, seasonal items this time of the year. And I was laughing when I got asked this question because I think I got asked a similar question last year, but it was related to jelly beans when there was like a huge jelly bean intro workout trend on like TikTok or something, or I think some like NFL football players were eating jelly beans on the sideline and people were all up in arms of like, oh, he shouldn't be eating candy. And then other people were like, oh, it's simple sugar and it's good for him. And you can absolutely do that. And there's no problem. So I just laugh because these kind of questions pop up and it's a little bit more seasonal, I find, because I don't find people are out here slamming, you know, their leftover Halloween candy or anything in mid-June or anything like that. So, and I also think these questions are good because we can kind of just reshape the way we think about certain things. And, you know, the education we have around some of these topics can just help us make more informed decisions, more level-headed decisions, and not freak out because we're eating a little bit more candy or a little more dessert this time of the year. But this is a good question. All that being said, yes, like eating candy can be something that people do to increase their performance per se. And there's different training modalities that maybe this is more relevant to, different training durations, training intensities that maybe I'd be more inclined to being like, yeah, you know what, having some extra carbs might be more helpful for you and can be included and should be included versus times where it's like, yeah, you know what, you probably don't need to be doing that, you know, and you can do it, but it's not something that's necessarily essential or going to be a big difference maker by any means. But if we break it down, right, because as we're eating candy or as we're talking about candy here, we're kind of talking about glucose and simple sugars and processed sugars, right? But we kind of like look at the training standpoint and how our body utilizes energy. Like when you're training or when you're exercising or you're going on a 5K or even if you're doing an hour lift session, like, you know, again, depending on intensities and all this stuff, but your body's main fuel source comes from stored glycogen, which is predominantly stored within your muscle cells. And as you train, glycogen stores get depleted, which means you start to maybe lose the amount of energy that's available to you to get a lot of good output, a lot of solid output in whatever training that you might be doing. The fastest way to kind of refill your tank, I guess you can kind of say, but like how you can kind of re-up a lot of the energy, the sugars, the things that your body is burning off or utilizing during those training sessions is by eating simple sugars, right? And the reason for that is these simple sugars, these candies, hard candies, things really concentrated in like added sugar, which again gets a bad rap a lot of times. But this is why when you see like marathon runners, it's like they live off simple sugars. Like they live off 400, 500 grams of carbs a day. There's a reason they use energy gels. There's a reason they drink full sugar Gatorades. There's a reason they eat predominantly, fiberless or less fiber dense carbs and more, you know, quick and easy digestible carbohydrates in the form of simple sugars is because those simple sugars get converted to glycogen really quickly and really efficiently. And it can be a good kind of like burst of energy or a supplement or an aid to train your training performance essentially. And for these people, you can train harder, longer, have more output, just have better workouts because of that. So again, I think taking a step back here, like, when is this more applicable? When this might be more appropriate? Like, if you're somebody who's sitting here and does longer and higher training intensities, HIIT workouts, you know, maybe longer runs, training sessions that last longer than 90 minutes, even 60 minutes, I would say, sugary candy can absolutely help, you know, in certain amount of doses. Like, you having, you know, 10 packs of something or Nerds or whatever in a workout, like, I can't say that that's going to be the biggest bang for your buck, right? We got to think about hydration and electrolytes. And at this point, I'd also talk about, what are we eating before your workout or the night before? Or what does the totality of your diet look like? So it's not that just the added sugar thing is the missing link that people need to be prioritizing by any means, but it could be sprinkles on top of icing on top of a big ass cake, you know, that we're trying to bake here and kind of enjoy that. So it's part of the conversation. It's irrelevant for a lot of people, if we're being honest, but this time of the year, if you have a lot of leftover candy or you have candy you enjoy and, you know, you eat it around your training session, like, absolutely. Like, that could be a tool or something you do or lean on. And, you know, you don't necessarily have to throw your candy away. Like, you could also just throw the candy away. Like, if you feel guilty and you're trying to justify why you should be eating this candy, it's like, I'm not going to be an advocate for people eating more candy at the end of the day. But it is one of those things that has a place, has a utility for a handful of people. And it could be something to experiment with. And you might find that you feel good with it. And you having a handful of jelly beans or gummy bears or whatever it is, like, before you're going to your workout or, you know, during your workout, like, that could be helpful for some people, you know. But also, so could eating a fucking banana, you know, or like a rice cake, or, you know, half a bagel or something else that might have a little bit more substance, a little bit more, just maybe a little bit more nutrition in certain contexts. And you just don't have to do the same thing, you know, all the time. I think that's what I'm trying to get across here. Is like, you can experiment, you could do things differently. And as the seasons change and you have more exposure or different opportunities, or your training might change, like, there's stuff that can change with your nutrition and your pre, intra, and post-workout nutrition. But long story short, yeah, eating candy during or before workouts can be beneficial in certain contexts. And I want to just circle back on a word you used here, actually good for you. I know you probably didn't mean this, but, like, you know, if you haven't listened to me or followed me for a long time, you know my stance. Like, a lot of people know what I'm about to say, but, like, we don't talk about foods in good or bad context, right? Like, foods are, they don't hold any moral values, right? Like they're neutral, and it's what our perception is that, you know, people might be labeling these things as bad or awful or good or productive or helpful. But I don't find that being a super helpful way for people to think about food. It's like, hey, when you look at candy and when you look at the overall quality of your diet, it's like, hey, I might look at these candy bars or these jelly beans or whatever it is. It's like, yeah, they're very nutrient poor. They have a lot of sugar. Sugar also being used in good or in certain contexts that can be very helpful, like we just talked about with working out. But that's probably not something that we want to be doing a ton of over time. And, you know, for those reasons, we can sprinkle things in here and there. And, you know, maybe you eating your favorite chocolate bar or dessert or whatever, like, you know, right before your workout or during your workout, like, maybe that's better than, you know, you eating three or four of those things after a dinner and you're overly stuffed for the night. So, like, there's, you know, situational differences that might, you know, come into play when we're making some of these recommendations. But start to look at food as like, hey, what is the nutrient density of these things? What is the calorie density? What is the, you know, protein content, right? Like, what are some of the benefits or some of the things that might make this food more helpful or less helpful within the context of our overall healthy diet and what my goals are and so forth? So keep those things in mind. But long story short, yeah, leftover Halloween candy this time of the year or going into the holidays or, you know, towards the end of the year can be something you do and lean on if that's something that you choose to do. Awesome. Next question is how to hit 10,000 steps consistently. We've talked about steps and the importance of getting steps and why being more active and why having a higher step target is really important. The more I've been a coach, though, and the more I've worked with real humans, the more I realize that 10,000 steps is not always practical for everybody. And although I think it could be a good starting point or a good number to shoot for or something that, you know, could be possible for people, I understand that that general blanket recommendation of everybody getting 10,000 steps a day is a little outdated, and it's not as helpful or as individualized as maybe it could be when we talk about recommendations around getting steps, getting more active, and just being less sedentary throughout the course of the day. Now, where does the 10,000 steps a day come from, would you might ask? It's kind of funny, and I can't sit here and say this with the most confidence, but I think it came from like a Japan study or a paper like back in the 60s or 70s. And this whole like 10,000 steps per day was kind of originated out of Japan back in the day. And it was just an arbitrary kind of number to help people shoot for, to just have better fitness level, support weight management, and just like having an increased energy expenditure throughout the course of the day. But that's something that's been adopted. It's been kept around, and it's been something that's kind of been amplified over the last, you know, decade or two. And it's a number that probably isn't going away. Again, do I think 10,000 steps is a bad number or dangerous number to shoot for? Absolutely not. Like if somebody can get that and they can do that consistently and they can build a lifestyle around that, like I think that's phenomenal, right? But we have to acknowledge people's starting points, okay? And if we look at the actual data and statistics, at least in America, I think the average American is walking less than 3,000 or 4,000 steps a day. And you know, unfortunately, I know and have met a lot of people and have worked with people who are getting even less than 3,000 steps per day, which is just, it's insane, but it's not uncommon. Like it's not as uncommon as you might think. And I think the listener, you know, listening to this podcast episode, if you've been with me for a while, it's like, you're probably somebody that has a lot of, fucks you're giving about your health, and you probably make an effort to go on walks, and you make an effort to lift, and you make an effort to get fruits and vegetables in, you make an effort to track your food on occasion, you make it an effort to eat, you know, better in certain contexts and do things that future you are going to be grateful for, more likely than you are not, right? So I'm kind of preaching to the choir here to a certain extent, but a lot of people out there might be just shocked to hear that, like, oh shit, some people get 2,000 steps per day. Like, I don't even know how that's possible. Like, some people get 2,000 steps before they even leave for work in the morning. But that's a reality, man. Like in the just environment that we live in today, like if we look at, you know, work-life balance, just lack of activity, the average American just doesn't really exercise at all during the day, gets less than 10 to 20 minutes of exercise in every single day. We have kind of a country that like loves video games now, you know, like TikTok and social media and screen time, whether it's on your phone or, you know, accounting for work stuff, but also it's just like coming home and watching sports or TV shows or whatever sitcoms on, and, you know, all the new seasons that are coming out. It's like we live in an environment where it's easier to not get as many steps. Like it takes effort to be healthy. It takes effort to go out of your way and to get more activity in throughout the course of the day, throughout the course of the week. And so I think when we take all of these things into consideration, like this 10,000 step per day range, like might not be a target that you asking this question or you listening to this podcast necessarily needs to shoot for right now. And for me, and again, this is also kind of an arbitrary recommendation, like if we're being real, like more steps can be better, but after a certain, you know, after a certain range, like you getting 12, 13, 14,000 steps, like there's somewhat of a diminishing return after we get to that point. Maybe we'll talk about that in a second. But I do think for a lot of people, like objectively looking at what their averages are for the last week, the last month, even the last year, and just adding a couple thousand, like just setting the bar a little bit higher than where you've been consistently getting to, whether you've putting an effort to get more steps in or not. And just start to slowly, if you are not at 10,000, 8,000, you know, 9,000 steps a day, like if you're starting at 3, 4, 5, like add 2,000, add 3,000 steps to your goal on average for the week, and see if you can slowly start to build some consistency around that. Because what I see happen a lot of times, and it's kind of cliche to say as just somebody in the fitness space, but it's like, don't go from 0 to 100, you know, like take baby steps. But like, it's very true, you know, like a lot of people going from 0 to 5 days of exercise, like high intensity exercise or 5 days of training a week, like it's not going to be practical or sustainable or enjoyable for people in those situations, right? Or maybe they'll do it for a week or two, but then they'll fall off and then have a month where they don't train at all. Like that's a reality that a lot of people live in as well. But the same kind of applies to steps, where it's like you're figuratively speaking, metaphorically speaking, like you're just getting off the couch and you're trying to get 10,000 steps a day. Like, man, you might bust your ass and do that for a week straight, 2 weeks straight, but maybe it's requiring so much effort and it's not something that you enjoy, or it's really taking away, you know, from, you know, time that you might be spent doing other things, for example. Maybe it's become so much of a stretch and it's not going to actually reflect what you're going to do over the lifespan or over the next year, 2 years, 3 years. Man, I'd rather have that person lower the bar a little bit, and maybe instead of getting the 3,000 steps, they get 5,000 consistently, or they get 6,000 steps consistently. You know, I think as a bare minimum, 7,000-8,000 steps a day for most people could be a good general recommendation. Shooting for that 10 is a good next step. But if you are not consistently getting 7,000 steps a day, I would say that is the number maybe you start shooting for in the first place. Start building some consistency around hitting that number, and then increasing from there if it fits, or if it's something that you decide would be worth it to you. Okay. So I know this didn't answer this question perfectly, where it's like, how do you get 10,000 steps a day? I think the question, a better question that people should be asking themselves is like, how many more steps could I practically get? You know, it's going to take work, but could I start to get or start to shoot for that's going to make a meaningful difference? And for a lot of people, adding a couple thousand, 3,000 steps on average for the week to what you're already doing is going to be far more impactful, far more, you know, it's not going to be easy, but it's going to be a little bit more practical for you to get to and kind of conceptualize like how you're going to go about doing that. Maybe it's an extra 20-minute walk a day. Maybe it's 10-minute walks after every meal that you eat. Maybe it's a walk at lunch before you sit down or after your lunch at work for the day. Maybe it's you bundling the fuck up and going on a mile or 2 mile long walk with the dog and the wife or whoever after you eat dinner for the night, or after, you know, you get all your work stuff done for the day. You know, it's going to take effort, right? And it could also be done in the form of like more cardio sessions. Like maybe you want to get on the tread, or maybe you do a warm up or cool down after you lift, and you can spend 15 extra, 20 minutes extra a day. Like you could build it, you know, these steps around things that you're already doing. I find that that's a good thing. You know, you'll hear people say, oh, pace when you walk on the phone, or talk on the phone, or park farther away in the grocery store. You know, for some people, it might be like, go buy your groceries, like go walk the store instead of ordering Instacart or Uber Eats or whatever it is all week, you know? So I'm sure people can sit here and really sit back and think like, hey, there are opportunities for improvement in X, Y, and Z areas. But I really want people to just recalibrate what it means to, you know, to get more activity in. Because it doesn't mean you being perfect, hitting 10,000 steps every single day. And I don't think that's a fair target for everybody to shoot for. And it could be something where when you manage your expectations and you start a little bit slower, you might find that sticks a little bit easier, and it might be easier over time to get to higher targets, but it's because you started off a little bit slower in the first place that allowed you to do that, build confidence and build some actual habits and routines to where maybe you start to slowly turn up the knobs and some of those, you know, changes that you've made. And instead of going for a 10-minute walk, you know, in the morning before coffee or after work, maybe that turns to a 15 or 20 minute. Like once you start building these habits and routines, then you can slowly start to add or habit stack on top of those things. But I think in the beginning, it's not aiming, you know, super high. That's not very realistic for you, and you feeling pissed off and frustrated and upset that you can't stick to that. I think the confidence boost and the motivation for you to continue doing that comes from you having success early on, having wins early on. And that could be as simple as just changing the, you know, the end goal. The other thing I want people to remember is like, you don't have to get these exact same steps every single day. Like we take steps on averages for the week, at least with my coaching. So you might have more opportunity on the weekends or a few days a week where maybe you're not working as much, or maybe your to-do list is smaller that day, or maybe you have some time away from the kids, or you can go spend time in the gym. And you know, you getting like a 10, 11,000 step day, couple days, 2, 3 days a week, and you having a 4, 5,000 step day, you know, some of the other days of the week, but you average out 6,000 steps, 7,000 steps for the week, that can be helpful too. So it doesn't have to be a daily thing necessarily, even though I would encourage people to get up and move more consistently during the day. But I also can see a lot of benefit and a lot of practicality for people like, you know, taking advantage of the time and the, you know, the resources when they have available to them versus trying to force fit everything in their daily routine, where sometimes it might not be super feasible for some. So take averages for the week. That might help a little bit, but yeah, there's a lot of things that you could do, but I will leave you with that and my two cents on like the whole 10,000 step a day mark. Like I think the stress and the pressure of people feeling like they have to get more activity in, I think that's a net positive for most people. Like, of course, tracking and, you know, looking at steps or tracking food. Like there's a lot of things that could be taken to the extreme and done in a negative headspace and kind of have a net negative impact on people at the end of the day, depending on, again, what headspace that they're doing it with. But when it comes to an activity goal or a step goal, or you closing the rings on your Apple Watch, like I think the pressure that people feel with their watch or with data or with things saying like, hey, you know what, you didn't move a ton today and you still have X amount more steps to get today. And people are just going to be more likely to take that feedback at face value and try and do things about it. Like, I think the pressure that people feel to move their body more is going to be better than, you know, people maybe not tracking that at all or not even thinking about it at all. So yeah, we just live in a very sedentary environment. A lot of people have sedentary lifestyles right now. And I think just being really honest and objective with where you're at right now and slowly just changing things a little bit over the next week, 2 weeks, month, 2 months, like you can start to see some momentum build and you might be hitting that 10,000 step per day, you know, before you know it. But you don't need to hit 10,000 steps a day to be super healthy. Okay. Okay. Let's put that one to rest here. Next question. Thoughts on traveling with supplements or not a big deal missing a few days? I can't sit here and say that you making an effort to take all of your supplements that you take at home for like an extended week-long trip, or you traveling for Thanksgiving or Christmas, or, you know, doing a weekend getaway with the girls or a bachelor party. Like I don't think that is the thing that is going to be a difference maker in people's health over the long term. I feel confident saying that. I think it depends on the person though, you know, like some people might, and the person asking this question where it's like, yeah, you know what, like for me, like my vitamins or what I take supplement wise, it's kind of my ritual, or I have protein bars or supplements or creatine or things that I do that make me feel better throughout the course of the day that are health promoting, but maybe also help me hit my protein target for the day, right? Or maybe help me get my micronutrients in because I take my multivitamin every single day, regardless what my diet looks like. Like, you know, I can't sit here and say people who do that and who want to take their supplements on a trip, like shouldn't do that. Like if you can fit that in, it's, if we're being real, it's not that big of a deal, right? It's like, if you're even gone for a week and you want to take a bag of protein powder, or if you want to, you know, fill up a little baggie of creatine or take your creatine with you, you know, like who's to say that's a bad thing to do? It's not, it's going to be helpful. And it could be something that while you're on your trip, while you're away from your normal environment, gives you some sort of reflection or familiarity with what it, you know, what your normal routine might be at home. And you might be more inclined to make more health promoting decisions on some of those trips. Like you starting your day with a protein shake or a little smoothie or your normal vitamin stack in the morning before you go out to breakfast. Like, you know what, maybe you make different decisions and that's something that is kind of like an anchor to you and your goals and what's important to you. And, you know, for that same person, like I can't sit here and say you shouldn't do that. I think that could be a great idea. And for being real, it's not that difficult to take, you know, like a little pill organizer or whatever on your trip for Monday to Friday, you know, or taking a bottle or two or putting it in your backpack or your carry-on, putting it in your golf bag or something. But I also don't want people to think that they're missing out on a ton of things or benefits, or they're going to be set back a month because they didn't take their creatine for 5 days when they went on a work trip. Like that's just not going to happen either. Okay. So I think depending on the person, depending on the situation, depending on the length of the trip, depending on the supplements, the reason you're taking those supplements, I think we could give a different answer to everybody. But if you can make it happen and you feel like that's something that makes you feel good, and, you know, someone might find that, you know, whenever they take their digestive enzymes and their multivitamin, and maybe they take a, you know, acidophilus or something like probiotic when they go to Mexico or whatever, just for digestion purposes, like, yeah, I think that could be great, you know, but I don't want people sitting here thinking that they have to do that to have a good time or to have a good trip or to maintain their progress or to be healthy while they're traveling. Cause that's not the case. It really isn't. And I think for most people, like alleviating some of that stress or that expectation that they have to be perfect while traveling, like I think that could be a net benefit, or it could be very helpful for people at the end of the day as well. So I don't have a perfect answer for this one, but if you can make it happen, if it's something important to you and if it's something that you want to prioritize, like do your thing. But I don't want you sitting here thinking it's a deal breaker. It's going to make or break anything, because it's absolutely not. And you getting back to your normal routine when you get home is going to be just fine. Okay. Cool. Next question. Thoughts on the chicken, broccoli, rice diet? I'm trying to cut 10 to 15 pounds fairly quickly. Oh boy, I'm going to try and get through this question quickly because I have a couple other ones that I want to talk about, but we've all been there. Like, let's be real. Like the listener, the myself, you know, people, you know, like everyone's done the chicken, rice, broccoli diet at some point, right? Like everyone's done the typical bodybuilder type, you know, weekly meal prep for a period of time. And my question back to you is like, how long did that last? Or are you still doing it? Because I think that is a good guiding question where it's like, yeah, you know what? I don't do chicken and broccoli anymore because it fucking repulses me to even think about that. And I did it for so long that I don't want to see it, you know? For some people, like they might be like, yeah, you know what? That's a staple meal prep for me. And I don't do it all the time, but I do it somewhat frequently and it's really simple and it takes me less than an hour to do on the weekends. And it's just something that sets me up for the week. Like, I don't know if there's a perfect answer for everybody in every situation here, but I think if we break this down with kind of some of the layers with it, the whole chicken, broccoli, rice diet, is that better than going out to lunch every day? Is that better than some other alternatives? Or is that better than not eating in certain contexts? Like, yeah, I think there's a lot of nutrients, a lot of good things that can come from following this eating regimen for lunches or lunches and dinners or just dinners for the week. So I do think that there's pros for them, right? And I think for a lot of people, if you're trying to lose weight, like this is another way that you can control calories. If we look at like, if we look at like enjoyment of food, if we look at food variety, what we see in research is that people who habitually eat similar things tend to eat less over time because you're less likely to overconsume or overeat or eat more calories or more things because all the foods that you're eating all the time are super delicious and yummy, right? And they have different flavor profiles and texture profiles and all this stuff. So like it can be easier to control your calories and maybe help you with adherence if you're in a fat loss phase or a dieting phase by following similar eating patterns and you know, different types of routines with your nutrition. But even if you're just eating the same thing over time, like that might have some pros and some benefits at the end of the day. If we look at some of the cons, I think the cons list might outweigh some of the pros in some of these contexts, but man, like, if you're looking for sustainability and your idea of like, hey, when I cut weight, when I lose weight, all it's going to take is chicken and broccoli and then I'll get to my goal weight. It's like, you're probably not sustaining that weight loss long-term. Like you're probably somebody who's likely regaining and losing weight over and over again, you know, year after year, decade after decade. Like the further away from, you know, what you can see yourself doing forever, you know, when you do some of these kind of dieting protocols or fat loss protocols, like the less likely you are to sustain that progress over time. So yeah, maybe there's some utility and maybe you see progress with it. And maybe you see 5 pound weight loss within a month stretch every time you do this diet. But like the second question I would ask you is like, is that something that is actually helping you over the long term? Or is that teaching you things? Is that teaching you how to meal prep differently? Is that teaching you how to eat differently or to navigate social situations? Is that teaching you how to cook different foods or how to have different diversity or foods in your eating pattern that are giving you different, you know, nutrient profiles different than the broccoli and chicken that you might be eating? So, and overwhelmingly the answers are no to that. Like they're not helping people do some of those things. So I think there's cons when we talk about this type of eating pattern for a lot of people as well. And for the most part, like most people who do the chicken, broccoli, rice diet, like they don't do that shit forever. And again, unless you're a bodybuilder, which is a different conversation because there are, you know, much more intentional, much more rigid, much more, you know, intense dieting protocols that these people might follow because they're getting on stage. But for the average person, like I don't think that that's the go-to that everybody needs that is going to help everyone see the progress they want, at least over the long term. You know, short term, it might have some utility in certain contexts, but I don't know. I can't sit here and say that that's a good thing for a lot of people to do, having been somebody that's done that before and has gone and experiment through that as well. Like I'm sitting here, you know, sharing a similar experience with you at the end of the day too. The other big reason, again, for why this might not be super helpful is like we have to appreciate the micronutrients and the different food variety, the different nutrients that we get from different foods, right? Different carb sources offer different fiber profiles or nutrient profiles. Different vegetables, different fruits, different colors have different nutrients and micronutrient profiles, have different plant compounds that might be helpful. Different protein sources have different amino acid profiles, have different protein content, have different, you know, maybe satiating benefits, or has less or more saturated fat, or other things included in it. And I think diversity is a big buzzword in kind of nutrition today, but it's a really important one. And it's something that I want people to kind of take to heart. And maybe your guidelines for the week are like, okay, I have a protein source, a fiber source, and I have a carb source. And that's how I construct my meals. And sure, maybe a week it's chicken, broccoli, rice, but maybe the next week it's, you know, ground turkey or ground beef and asparagus and quinoa, right? And then the next week it's a whole wheat bagel and, you know, some sauteed, you know, root vegetables or something. And it's a salmon patty, or it's a turkey burger, or it's chicken thighs, right? Or it's other protein sources that maybe have different nutrient profiles than the chicken breast and the broccoli and the white rice that you're always eating. So that would be my two cents. It's just, maybe if you keep that eating philosophy for a time you're in a diet phase, I think that can be helpful. But just add different foods, different colors, different ingredients to the rotation. And, you know, you might find that that is something that is helpful. It helps you learn how to meal prep. It helps you learn how to be more inclusive. It helps you appreciate different food groups. And I think that that can be a net benefit for a lot of people when done in the right headspace. So that's my two cents. But I think for most people, just recommending the chicken, rice, broccoli diet and individualizing the portion sizes, I just don't know if that's super helpful. Awesome. Last question I'm going to answer here in a couple minutes because I got to go. Will I lose muscle if I don't work out a week and barely eat? I was sick. I think I want to include this and talk about this question because this is a question that I personally would have asked back in the day, or 3-4 years ago, or been somebody that was overly concerned with like losing my gains or progress if I had a small speed bump, you know, in my month or in my program, or, you know, things that happened over the course of the year. Like this kind of stuff, missing a week or 2 weeks of training, like the thought of that, you know, fucking killed me back in the day. And I wanted to answer this question because I really want to give people a little bit more peace of mind when it comes to their training and when it comes to building consistency around kind of the gym and seeing progress over time. But I don't want you to worry. I don't want you to worry about this at all, right? Even if you're somebody who has to miss 9 months of perfectly good training because you tore your Achilles or something playing basketball, which I never would wish on anybody. But even in those situations, like, you will come back from that and you will be fine after that. Like I just don't want people to stress over the small things and stress over things that sometimes they don't have control over. Because that stress, that anxiety of missing out or not being perfect is likely causing more harm for your mental health and maybe your physical health than actually missing those workouts in the first place. And when we look at this question, I think there's a lot of different ways and corners and nuances that we can talk about this in relation to. You know, this person mentioned like, hey, if I missed a week of lifting and I barely ate, like when we look at different types of inputs here, it's like, okay, taking into consideration how much we're eating, like, are we eating at like maintenance calorie range, or, you know, you in a deficit, or are you not eating at all because you're sick or not feeling very good? That's a big component, right? And then there's also the training side of things. It's like, are you literally not training at all? And are you bed bound? Or maybe you're not lifting and doing your normal workouts for the week, but you're walking around doing chores, doing the stuff you normally do. I think there's just a ton of different answers that you'll get in response to all these things, depending on what situation that you find yourself in. But moral of the story, around this 2 to 4 week range is when we start to see people losing muscle, okay? And not, this isn't something where it's like, hey, at 2 weeks, you've significantly lost muscle mass from not lifting and you're eating at maintenance. It's like after 2 weeks, after 3 weeks is when you start to maybe see some noticeable drop-offs or some dips in muscle mass or strength, right? Which is kind of a long time. It's actually kind of promising if you think about it. And this changes, right? If you're eating at maintenance, maybe you're eating at maintenance, like, yeah, that 4 week mark, that 3 week mark maybe is a little bit more realistic and you're walking around more, like you are at less risk for losing muscle, even though you're not training consistently. Now, the person who is not eating, who is bed bound or who is in a hospital, they are going to lose muscle so much more quickly and more rapidly compared to the other person in the other situation. And again, there's things that maybe you could do to try and be like more protein shakes, getting liquid protein calories in. If you can get up and walk when you can, like if you're, you have the flu or if you're in the hospital, but you can like get up and get some steps in every now and then. Like I think there's some ways around that. But again, it's like you got to make the best of the situation that you're in. But most people are asking this question in the context of like, fuck, I got the flu or I got the strep throat or my kid brought me home of, you know, head cold this weekend and I'm out for 4 days. It's like, you're not going to lose any meaningful progress for, you know, a 3 to 4 day stretch, 5 day stretch. So I just want people to stop stressing about that. And I think this conversation even changes a little bit. If you're somebody who's missing 3 or 4 weeks of training, but you get one training session in a week, like that is fantastic. Like a lot of the research that we have, like the maintenance volume that it takes to keep your muscle mass is so low. It's like such a low bar that even if you're not training consistently like you normally do for 3 or 4 weeks, like you're not going to lose a ton of muscle mass, even if you're getting 1 or 2 workouts in a week. So I just want people to remember that. The last thing I'll say on this is the other question is like, how quickly will you regain some of this stuff back? And I think that's the question that people don't ask themselves. And I think that could be very helpful to think about in this context as well. Because the answer to that question is pretty fucking quickly, right? Like we have to remember when you take time away from the gym, like whether you plan to deload or whether you are taken out of the gym because you're sick or you can't lift because you broke your ankle like I did for, you know, a month straight, some benefits that might come out of that is you are actually resensitizing to the training stimulus that you're consistently putting yourself through. So when you start to lift again, you will regain that strength, that muscle back a lot quicker compared to you gaining that the first time around. So we just have a ton of research, like, you know, on and off kind of research where it's like, hey, people train and then they take breaks and they train and then they take breaks. And man, if we compare people who, you know, maybe if we look at a 2 month stretch, they train for 4 weeks, take a week or two off, and then they train for 4 weeks and then take another 2 weeks off versus somebody who trained 10, 11 straight weeks. Like, are those two groups of people going to have massively different results at the end of that time frame? Like, I have a hard time saying that's going to be that big of a difference. Maybe there's a slight advantage in certain contexts for the people training a little bit more consistently, but for the average person, you know, the general population listening to this, like, it's just not super applicable to you, like for general health, for general maintenance, for, you know, improving body composition and everything else. Like it's a lot less consequential than what you might think it is. So I just want you to remember that. And I get some of this research. If someone were to come at me, it's like, yeah, those research are usually done in untrained individuals. I get that. I really do. But there is some applicability to even a trained kind of, you know, person or trained populations. And moral of the story, I just don't want people freaking out as much as they do around this stuff because it's not helping. And the best thing you could do is just take care of your nutrition, get up when you can, get steps in, do things around the house, eat well, get a lot of nutrients, you know, take your vitamins, get back to the gym when you can and when you feel safe, and you will regain or, you know, get back to a place that, you know, where you were before you got sick or before that, you know, thing took you out of the gym. You'll get back to that place fairly quickly and you'll see likely nothing happen over the course of, you know, a year stretch or so. Like if someone's sitting here training 90% of the year and they miss 10% of training throughout the course of the year, even 85-80%, like that's phenomenal. And that's, you know, you're part of the top 10% in a lot of those cases. So just stop panicking. Okay. Cool. I got to go. Love you guys. Let me know if you need anything, have any other questions. I wanted to answer a couple others, but we'll save those for next time. Okay. If you ever need me, just ask. Until next time though, train with a purpose, train with intention, think with confidence as you work towards your own nutrition and fitness goals. Butchered that one, but you know what I'm saying. You've heard it plenty of times up until this point, but hope you have a good one. We'll talk to you soon. Peace. Thank you again for listening to this episode. If you found value and enjoyed it, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media. If you do, make sure you tag me so I can say thanks. Or if you're on iTunes, scrolling down and leaving a 5-star review would be much appreciated. And if you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always find me on Instagram at LukeSmithRD. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your day. I'll see you on the next episode.